The information and opinions presented in this ARC Energy Ideas podcast are provided for informational purposes only and are subject to the disclaimer link in the show notes.
This is the ARC Energy Ideas podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome to the ARC Energy Ideas podcast. I'm Jackie Forrest.
And I'm Peter Terzakian. Welcome back. Well, I've said on this program many times over the course, I think this is episode number 144, but on several of these episodes, I've said that I'm a child of the Cold War. I grew up in the 70s and I remember it quite well. And I'm wondering these days as I wake up why I'm getting flashbacks to the 1970s, you know, period of inflation, superpower confrontation, Russian aggression, spiking energy prices, fears of energy disruption. It just seems like such a flashback. And now we are day five of the Ukrainian invasion by Russia. And I don't know, it's just the parallels are just so shockingly similar. And how also I feel the naivety of how it is that we let ourselves get back into this situation is really quite disturbing over and above, you know, the tragedy and the loss of human life and the upset of the geopolitical balance of the world. So we've imposed sanctions, Jackie. So what's going on as we speak here and record?
First of all, I'll just say that although there were many signs this could happen, it was still really shocking to find out on whatever last Thursday that Russia actually was going to attack the Ukraine. In terms of sanctions, you know, originally they were, I would say, really weak. Actually had leaders in the U.S. saying, we're not going to target energy supply, which to me is kind of like, go for the thing that really hurts them. But the good news over the weekend, there was a little bit more movement on that. And it was announced that they would disconnect some banks in Russia from the SWIFT system, which means it's going to be very difficult for them to get money or exchange money with other banks. And they've also put sanctions on the Russia Central Bank. That has had an impact. Over the weekend, we saw a 30% drop in the ruble. Also, people believe that now all that cash that Russia had stored up here, they're not going to have access to most of it because of these constraints. So I do think that if this continues, we're likely going to see even greater sanctions on the SWIFT system. And I think this move already is probably going to somewhat impact the oil trade. Mm-hmm. But I think you're going to see probably an all-out banning of the SWIFT at some point if this continues, if the conflict continues.
I think it's safe to say it is going to continue. I mean, history would suggest that whatever era you look at where these sort of military confrontations escalate and the animosities grow. And, you know, I support standing up to a brutal dictator like Putin. However, I don't think we fully appreciate what these sanctions are going to do, even the ones that have been imposed and with the SWIFT system. The inability to exact trade in the oil markets is going to disrupt the global supply chains of oil, even if a little bit. It has big impacts.
Yeah, like just for example, the Russians export about 7 million barrels a day total. 3 to 4 of that goes to Europe, Asia around 2, and the U.S. 500,000 barrels a day.
Yeah.
That is a big number. And I mean, people are talking about what are some solutions. A deal with Iran, it could be that a deal with Iran is struck very shortly here because of this, but that would add like 1 million barrels a day.
Yeah.
So that's not going to totally replace the loss of potential from Russia. OPEC is having a meeting this week. Maybe they would add more supply, although most people think they won't. But they don't have the ability to add 7 million barrels a day. Maybe they could add an additional 1 or 2.
Mm-hmm.
And the U.S. is talking about a strategic oil release, but we'll wait and see. But generally, those are fairly small. I mean, there's only so much oil in the strategic oil reserve.
I don't even think we need to be talking about 5, 6, 7 million barrels a day. The disruption in the tight market that we were already in, so the disruption of even 500,000 to 1 million barrels a day, is going to have consequences. It's going to ripple through the system. And so we'll see what that all means. We already have an oil price this morning that's, I don't know, I think it's around $95, $96. It fluctuates, but it's a very, very volatile and vulnerable situation depending on what's happening. And I think that there is a structural shift now, given this new geopolitical reality and the inability of the Western oil companies, the IOCs, independent oil companies, to be able to rapidly address this situation. So we have a situation already where we were dealing with inflation, with supply chain issues, with the Western independent oil companies really not responding to price signals and bringing on more supply. So it's really opportune for us to be able to bring in a special guest, which I am delighted has agreed to come in, someone I've known for over 20 years. I want to introduce to our audience Murray Mullen, President and CEO of the Mullen Group Limited. The Mullen Group Limited is the third largest trucking company in Canada, give or take. We'll hear more from Murray here in a minute. But Murray's going to come and talk to us about supply chains, inflation, been in the business of hauling oil and gas equipment in the oil fields of Canada for 75 years, I think, or something like that. So we're going to talk about that. So no further ado, Murray, welcome.
Peter, great to be here.
Yeah.
It's great to get reconnected.
It is.
It's been a long time.
Yeah.
Pre-COVID times.
Pre-COVID times, yeah.
Yeah, we used to get together and banter back and forth and think we could solve world problems, but all we did was talk.
Well,
but,
we can, Murray.
Yeah,
no,
we
can.
No,
nobody
close.
Listens.
Right? Yeah, we got close. I know. Unfortunately, it was just the two of us.
Yeah, exactly. Well, welcome. Why don't you start off by telling us about the Mullen Group? I know it's a family business that's been around since, what, 1949?
Well, it started as a family, independent. My dad started the business as an entrepreneur, one person, one truck, 70-some years ago. And, you know, typical family business, it grows and it struggles and it does this and that. And then, you know, we went public in 1993. You'll recall those days,
yeah.
Early days as we went public. And I think that's when we first met, Peter,
yeah.
Is that, you know, part of it was us, Mullen. We had a good business. We were successful. The biggest issue at the time was there was an energy renaissance going on in Canada. There was a lot of capital coming into Alberta, into the energy business, and we were in the right spot at the right time, and we grew. We went public to grow,
yeah.
And that was the start of our real growth platform. So, you know, before we went public, we're doing $70 million a year in business. And, you know, today, fast forward, we're on a run rate of $1.8 billion. So a lot has changed,
yeah.
Since we went public. And, you know, we always, I think, you know, when you're investing or you're thinking about things just going bottom left to upper right, well, we're still doing that.
Yeah.
And we're on that path. But it's different today. What allowed us to go public was being in the energy business. Because a lot of capital coming into the business.
Yeah, there's a lot of rigs to haul around, a lot of equipment.
The oil companies, natural gas companies, let's call them the producers, were given the green light to go and increase production. To increase production, you need services. That's who brings production on. The producers have the land, they have the know-how, but you need services to actually do the work. Then we went through that phase where, you know, the market and in certain movements really put the handcuffs on the producers to grow production.
Mm-hmm.
What will be interesting today, Peter, Jackie, is whether we're going to get the green light again to go increase production in North America, and let's call it, from our perspective, Canada. That will be an interesting debate over the next bit. I don't know how it'll play itself out, but suffice to say, we were involved in 93 and we rode it for two decades, that capital flow coming into Alberta and into the oil and gas business in Canada. And then we saw it fading. We saw two things happening. One is we saw it started to run into some problems coming into Canada. And there was two really fundamental issues that I latched on to. One was this thing called multi-stage fracturing and the Permian.
Mm.
Every well they drilled, they added production quite handsomely. You needed multi-stage fracturing to make the Permian work. We all know that. The second was the political movement in Canada move away from Western Canada being too powerful and being too successful. And that irritated certain people in politics and in Canada. And the political will in Canada to support the energy business seemed to be changing dramatically. So those two things forced me to think about what's the future of more capital coming into the Western Canadian Basin, which was our lifeblood for services. So we pivoted away, Peter, starting in about 2012.
You started acquiring companies and
yeah,
all sorts of
we just I moved more I moved
trucking
more,
logistics
yeah all trucking and logistics and moving more towards the consumer part of the economy rather than the capital deployment side of the company. The energy business is a master of user of capital.
Yeah.
If you're going to grow production.
Right.
And I noticed that we needed to be more stable. And I think I made the right call on that because we saw what happened from 2014 through till now. So we're going to be pretty close to a decade where we've underinvested in the Canadian energy space.
So we're
traditional.
We're going to talk about that. But I, you know, I can't think of a better person to give us a lens on the economy right now than you, because as the third largest trucking holding company in Canada and beyond, you have a lens not only on the logistics of the entire economy, but also still maintain that lens on the energy business. So what we want to talk about is sort of the broad picture about inflation, what these high oil and gas prices mean in terms of transporting goods and services to the people. Then we'll switch to back to the oil and gas economy, you see. And then finally, of course, there's the whole net zero imperative and how you see trucking fleets evolving and changing over time.
Okay, well, with that, let's get going with the first part, supply chain. So start with the COVID-related supply chain issues. What is the situation right now with hauling and logistics? And I'm sure with all these border closures that we just recently had, it's maybe even worse. But how bad is it? And do you think there's are solutions coming?
Well, COVID has multi different facets to it, obviously. And let me just use just this moment to talk just about the supply chain. What happened with the supply chain when COVID hit? Let's go back to March of 2020. The very first thing that happened was China shut down their economy because of COVID, the outbreak of COVID. They tried to control it. So it was China that started the supply chain bottleneck by shutting everything down, shutting down manufacturing facilities, shutting down cities, and shutting down ports. So everything got backed up, and it all started in China. So once you stop that, then it disrupted the flow of all the container ships that are moving across the ocean. They couldn't get into port, and then they couldn't get out of port to go deliver. So it all started in March of 2020. And then it just kind of got worse since then. So as China opened up, that started the flow of goods again. But along the way, in came our political and government and policy responses to COVID. All of the central bankers and all the everybody panicked. And they flooded the system with money, Peter. You know that. Just quantitative easing, this new economic model and theory. We'll just print it and give it to the government, let them spend it, and we'll buy your bonds for nothing, and everybody's happy. But what happens when you flood it with too much money? A frustrated economist like I am would say to you, well, there's only one outcome. Too much money in the system will lead to inflation. Well, guess what? We got inflation. And inflation's going to happen because you increase demand. Mm-hmm. We increase demand by giving people lots of money, which you could argue was not the right thing, the wrong. I'm just explaining to you why we have inflation. That was a consequence and a byproduct of too much money entering the system. Along with that, what they totally missed was that the supply chain was totally compromised because other government protocols that came in slowed everything down. So, for example, because there's too much demand from consumer demand, then there was bottlenecks, those container ships that were coming from Asia, primarily China, that's the big, the big producer for the world, those ship lines, the transit times were now double. Not because of ocean time, but because of waiting time in Chinese ports, because of bottlenecks, and in West Coast, North American ports, example, 15 to 30 days each end. That virtually doubled transit times, which effectively reduced supply of container ships by 50%. Because you can't add a new container ship in a week. So we had a reduction of supply because they couldn't transport as much. You know, the largest container ships would haul upwards of 24,000 containers per shipment.
Wow.
24,000. And remember, that's each way now. 24,000 in, 24,000 out. You've now reduced capacity by 50% at the same time, even, you know, that you've got high demand. So what happened? container rates went from $3,500 a container and went up by upwards of tenfold.
Jeez. Wow.
So all of these things, when you layer them all together, it's not just the energy business, it was the supply chain, it's demand. And then the last part of this equation, what I'll tell you is just generally everybody's less productive today because of COVID protocols.
Mm-hmm.
Government has implemented new restrictions on when you can go to work, how often you should go to work, stay at home, all these protocols. And we've now turned from giving great customer service, which was the, you know, just mm-hmm. the acronym for the capitalistic system, make sure the customer's happy, to where now I can tell you as a CEO, I need to be very, very focused on health and safety of my employees, first and foremost, not on customer service. That is not something that's number one today on my list. I have to make sure that I'm concerned about the health and well-being of our people.
Well,
that
bottlenecks
the system. Yeah, that slows it down.
Talk about also, like, we hear about shortages of employees in almost every sector of the economy, but especially like trucking. So there's driver shortages and things. So how did that all of a sudden happen?
Well, I think it didn't all of a sudden happen. I think that it's just the incremental growth in the economy along with the incremental reduction in supply. But I think truck drivers, I think there's a shortage of plumbers, I think there's a shortage of doctors and nurses. Now that's empowering labor. Labor's not going to sit by idly and just let inflation eat into their pie and into their take-home pay. They're demanding more of the pie. And that's the next round of inflation pressure that I think is going to hit us today, which is wage inflation. Mm-hmm. Started as supply chain, then it went into energy, and now it's going into the wage inflation. I don't think it's transitory, Peter.
So there's big societal changes all around us, as you know. And you know, one of those societal changes is also how we shop and the Amazon and online shopping and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, Jackie and I look at the stats and we see the diesel consumption now back up to at least where it was pre-COVID, if not higher. And a lot of that's coming from the 18-wheelers that you manage. Talk about this whole online shopping thing.
The most important part that people need to understand about online shopping, about e-commerce, is that e-commerce is really an acronym for the individual, the consumer doesn't go do their own shopping or go to their own store, go to the store. Think about this. We used to go to the mall to pick up our goods, whatever we ordered, to go buy.
And you sure?
We used to go to the grocery store. We used to go to the coffee shop. We used to go everywhere and do it on our own. Well, all of a sudden, it became in vogue to have it delivered to you. Okay, but that takes somebody to do it. So we've created this new cottage industry.
Mm-hmm.
You had millions of consumers that now don't want to go pick up their own goods with their own vehicle. So you had to have a new cottage industry and you have to employ people. So there's a lot of people that are now delivering goods in cities to people, to us, and that's taking potential workforce out of the long haul. We know that there's more economic activity, GDP today than there was in 2019, but it's done differently. And a lot of the jobs created have been in short haul, and that's taken away from long haul drivers. Why not? I mean, they get home. But consumers, we're part of the problem. We're asking somebody to deliver everything to us.
Yeah.
And it's not efficient. You are having somebody deliver
a tube of toothpaste.
I mean, I've seen younger generation having their Starbucks delivered to them. You got to be kidding me.
Well, let's switch to oilfield activity. You talked about 10 years ago, your company pivoted to be more diversified. So how much of your business is from the oilfield today? And just give us some context. Is it mostly in the conventional industry or the oil sands?
So I'll frame it in this. To tell you how much change there's been, our business, same store sales, same companies we have today that we had back in 2013-14, Those businesses have lost $600 million in business. We lost $600 million of revenue and margin with that. Our company's larger, but those businesses have lost $600 million. That was all out of the oil and gas service side. That was dealing with the oil sands. That was dealing with the drill bit. That was dealing with service work and the build-out of infrastructure to service increased economic activity. We hit rock bottom in 2020, just like most of the industry did. It's had a stubborn recovery and starting in 2021, which starting to see it a little bit more in 22, but we're not even close to where we once were.
What's the latest chatter from your oil and gas producer customers? Is there any change in the way they're thinking and what's coming out of their boardroom meetings in terms of what they might do in terms of spending more? Or is it still wait and see? I'll see if these high prices last before I drill. Then there's the whole ESG environmental financial directives on don't drill, give the money back.
You folks are deeply involved in this. I'll tell you from what I see. First of all, I don't think it's the price of oil that will drive capital investment in Western Canada. We're really not an oil basin. We're an oil sands basin.
Yeah.
But we're not an oil basin. I think you know that.
Yeah.
Yes, we have oil, but not anywhere
it's completely
near.
Well, like, over the last
really, it's irrelevant.
30 years, yeah.
Is there going to be any capital allocated to the oil sands for new oil sands development?
Unlikely.
I don't see it. You probably don't see it either.
No.
I think the biggest thing that we're looking for, Peter, is what's happening with natural gas.
Mm.
We're a natural gas basin in Western Canada. And so we'll take our cue from natural gas. And natural gas prices are higher. And we know why. Demand is up around the world for natural gas. Canada's missed the boat on natural gas because we can't get to the world markets because we haven't built out LNG facilities. That's the only, mm-hmm. It's the only practical way to get natural gas from Canada. It's landlocked here and get it to Asia or Europe. Right. And, you know, we can't build a pipe from here to Europe and you can't build a pipe from here to Asia. LNG is the most practical way. And we've got, one facility that's being built right now? Lots of plans, but one facility under construction at Kitimat. We're involved in that, and it is going stubbornly slow.
Yeah, I think I was looking back at my notes over the weekend, and in 2014, right, it's only actually seven and a half years ago, there was something like 17 West Coast LNG terminal projects. Or maybe it was 18, under various stages. I think 9 of them had actually been approved by what was then the NEB. And only one survived all the regulatory friction and hurdles, mm-hmm. LNG Canada. But it's not scheduled to open until 2025.
Right.
But when it does, and now who knows now, with there may be a complete shift in policy that may encourage more gas to be able to serve the Western world.
So Pete, getting back to the question about it, I think the cue card for us on terms of how well our oil field services business will do will be predicated upon how well Canada responds to the growing global demand for natural gas. Europe may not be getting quite as much from Russia as they've been getting for quite some time. Germany is really in a pickle right now.
Yeah.
And so will Canada play in that arena, or we'll just be a bystander and watch what's going on and away it goes. It doesn't matter what happens to the price of natural gas. It's, from my perspective, it matters whether those producers get the go single, increase production so that we can sell that to other markets.
Yeah.
I have not seen that yet, Peter. We have no export capacity other than pipe to the United States. That's it.
Yeah. Well, and I think we're learning that building new pipe in Canada is very expensive, right? We heard the TMX is going to be very expensive, and Coastal Link, I know that the price of that pipeline is higher than they expected. So that, I think that's another financial barrier for investment here too.
Well, I really wonder whether outside capital will either embark trying to build in the Canadian landscape the way it is right now. I mean, you saw what happened to the Coastal Gas just a few weeks ago. Where the project, you know, there's people working on the project and was attacked violently.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have any ability to really control these things right now, in my estimation. So I don't know why capital would even come to Canada. Well, I don't understand it.
Yeah, under that set of conditions or historical conditions, no. But I think in the last week, things have changed overnight.
If they have, Peter, then you will look, then I will be thinking, okay, I will put more capital to work and get prepared to grow our oil field services business. Until I see that go card, I have no choice but to put our capital to work where I think it's got the best, you know, the best opportunities. And right now, I'm still a sideliner when it comes to investing in oil field service.
Well, I think that's prudent because by the time there's policy shifts and emphasis shifts, and then it trickles down into investment decisions by your customers and all that, like we're talking a year away.
Oh,
at least. But I do think there is going to be a significant policy shift here and in the United States on the gas side, given what's happening in Europe, which actually affects the whole, it's not just Europe now. It's back to, as I said, the 1970s. It's East versus West. And this is, you know, we've neglected energy security in the energy policy equation for over a decade. And guess what? We were naive to think it had gone away and it's back. And so stay tuned on that. But let's talk about the third subject, which is net zero by 2050 and turning over your truck fleet to, say, hydrogen.
If we're going to get to net zero, we'll have to move away from diesel-powered engines, which is the predominant way of powering your units today. And I see that it's emerging. And we've already invested in electric trucks to deliver around big cities. So we'll invest in electric trucks to deliver within the city of Calgary or Vancouver or Toronto. And we can get them back home to our terminal and we can recharge them at night, just like your Tesla. Then you can go to work again tomorrow and away it goes. If you're going to do regional or long haul, which is how the supply chain really works, you've got local, you got regional. Calgary to Edmonton is a regional move. And then you got long haul, which would be from Vancouver to Toronto, Calgary to Toronto, because that's the moving of the supply chain. The regional will be done. We've invested in CNG trucks. We've got them.
It's compressed natural gas.
Compressed natural gas. But once again, you've got to have a fueling station. So we've got that fueling station on our site. So those trucks just do lanes. That's regional lanes where I can control it. The long-haul business, that's really complicated. I don't see it. But increasingly, Peter, we're going to intermodal, which is we pick up the freight, we take it to the rails, and then the rails deliver it to Toronto. We pick it up in Toronto. We take it to our terminal, de-stuff it, and deliver it with a fuel-efficient or a electric vehicle. I see that's where it's going to go. Specifically, your question about hydrogen, is there a place for hydrogen? There might be. We're studying it, Peter, but I don't see it as universal yet. Apply hydrogen to the rails, to those big engines that pull all that freight across the country. That might be a good place for hydrogen. Trucking, yes, you can get a hydrogen truck, but the last I looked, they did one in the Port of Seattle. It's $1 million per unit rather than $180,000. It's not there from an economic perspective yet. Yes, you can do it, but it's not economically feasible at the moment.
So that's the cost of the vehicle?
That's the cost of the vehicle.
Yeah, so a similar vehicle can do the same job. One that can consume hydrogen is $1 million, and a diesel
You cannot use battery power for long-haul trucking because you need too much batteries, and they're heavy.
Yeah, it takes a lot of energy.
They take too, and then you got less payload, so it's not efficient.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like the next 5 to 10 years are difficult in a sense that changing over 3,500 trucks in your fleet takes time. You know, some of them can go electric, as you say, in the sort of city deliveries, potentially in the medium hauling and so on and so forth. But at the moment, the carbon tax comes in, you pass it through to your customers. It's sort of status quo. The cost of even buying some of these vehicles is going to go up because all commodities, whether it's lithium, and we've talked about this nickel, all the metals and minerals that go into batteries are going up as well. I mean, it's just sort of a very difficult period over the course of the next five years.
It's disruptive. And of those 3,500, a number of those are independent operators. So I'm not going to be able to convince them to go invest in a hydrogen truck or a electric truck or whatever. These are independent entrepreneurs.
They own owner-operators.
They're the owner-operators. We have our own fleet of trucks, company trucks that we invest in.
Yeah.
I have a decision to make on those ones, and I'll make the best decision I can to make sure that it makes economic sense.
Right.
But, Peter, all these things, you're exactly right. They're all inflationary.
What percentage of, let's just take Canada, the Canadian trucking fleet is owner-operator versus sort of company-owned?
Vast majority.
So this is also part of the problem then. So you have an owner of an 18-wheeler that is incented to basically drive the truck to its useful duty cycle, not to swap it out for a hydrogen truck, which he
because
or she can't afford.
Because it feels good. They're not going to do it because
and
it feels
also
good.
Also, the owner-operator has to fuel up, obviously, but that gets passed on to the consumer.
That's correct. As a company, I may be forced, and it might be the right thing to do, to go and invest in some of these new technologies and experiment and do the right things because my shareholders or activists, people want me to do it, and it feels good. But for an independent contractor, they're not going to do it because it feels good. They're going to do what is best for them. So there's a long road to haul here. And then I think everybody needs to be aware is that how much do we want to say we're changing the world if the world doesn't change? I mean, it's we've got some pretty good evidence right over the last week or so that you can have all these great theories you want, but
there's
other mitigating factors.
The thing is that we have to do a better job in terms of thinking about policy of the what I call like the micro barriers to adopting even new technology, like understanding that it's an owner-operator that has to pay to make the switch to a cleaner future, but and that there's cost to that in terms of who's going to pay. And then more broadly speaking, we also have to think about, I've always called it the four dimensions of energy, which is people want it cheap, clean, safe, and secure. And we've taken safe and secure and cheap for granted for too long. And now we have to think about all these dimensions and how to optimize them and balance everything in a very volatile period. So I guess much you're in the vehicle business, put on your seatbelt, right?
Well, there's going to be a massive amount of change. We all know that, as there has been in the past. We'll adapt to it. We'll change to it. But we go back to this one thing. The change that we're seeing today is going to change things. But it's going to be inflationary.
What we've seen in goods, the logistics and supply chains of goods, you've described how small changes in delay times leads to big inflationary pressures because so you got to put more stuff in warehouses, which costs money. And, you know, this is what I feel is the overlay to now the oil and LNG paradigm, where just in the last 5 days with the Russian invasion of Ukraine, you're going to start seeing major changes to the transport logistics of LNG, oil tankers, et cetera. And, you know, we have yet to see how the ripple effect of that's going to play out.
I would like to be an owner of natural resources right now. It will be interesting. A user of natural resources, you're going to pay more. And then it'll be very interesting to see how public policy now changes and whether it's more accommodative and supportive in Canada. I know you're optimistic. I'm not optimistic. We can't get a damn thing done in this country. There's not the political will to do it.
Well, I would argue that, by the way, I wasn't optimistic, but I'm optimistic, more optimistic now, because all of a sudden we have to think about energy security and affordability. I wish we could end up on a lighter note, given everything that's going on out there. But thanks for joining us, Murray. You've opened up issues that we're going to be talking about, I feel, for a long time on this show. In the meantime, Jackie, take us
home. Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you for joining the show.
It was a pleasure to be here with you. So these are the old days of when we used to banter back and forth. And we just got to do it with Jackie today and maybe with a broader audience that you've been able to get over the last bit. So you've obviously been successful at it. Congratulations.
Thank you. And thanks to our audience. If you enjoyed this podcast, please rate us on the app that you listen to and tell someone else about us.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.